Hello, everyone, and welcome to The New Yorkers, a podcast by New York City Cop. I'm your host, Kelly Kopp, published photographer, New York City tour business owner, real estate content creator, podcaster, and above all else, a New Yorker. With me today, I have New York City street pianist and author Christopher Hull. I'm going to ask him a few questions.
Stand clear of the closing doors, please.
Hey, Chris, welcome to the show, my friend. How are you doing today?
Hey, Kelly. Thank you so much for having me. I'm doing great, and I am thrilled to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
So why don't you tell us, or we can both talk about how we met.
How we met?
And how did we meet? You tell me.
How did we meet?
Yeah.
I must have seen your work on Instagram, I think. It must have been that, and your content was very eye-catching, and your... The way you saw the world seemed quite suited to my work, which is quite visual in that it's not purely pianistic, having a piano out in the world. It is a three-dimensional situation that happens out in New York City. And it just occurred to me, without even having to think about it, that your work would be really suited for my art. And so I contacted you, and we talked a little bit back and forth on DM. And I think... if I remember correctly, we had about 6 months before we actually met.
Right, right.
We were going to do something for 9/11, which was the plan back in the spring when we first made contact.
Which we did do.
Too. And it was almost coincidentally, it ended up being 9/11 because the summer came and went, and it was just a serendipitous thing for us to come together in the way that we did.
It truly was. I think I actually may have commented on your post as initially. Because, you know, I thought what you did around the city with your piano was amazing and inspiring to so many others as well. And then the 9/11 video that we collaborated on together happened, which I think we're both super proud of.
Oh, it was an amazing moment. Yeah. It was an amazing moment. And shout out, of course, to... if it's appropriate to say shout out for such a somber memory, really, in the end, 9/11 was a tragedy that brought us together. But, that just happens to be how we met. And and the artist Clown Soldier had put a mural up above the subway on 2nd and Houston and on the F train stop, which is actually a rotating wall. It's curated by, I think there are a number of different curators.
Right.
But, every month it changes, and in September, when I saw what the mural was, which was of a firefighter who died, it was just a portrait, very simple portrait.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just, it seemed absolutely perfect to play the piano at this mural. And
I think
that was when I contacted you and I said, hey, this is really something that is going to be very touching and very powerful at the same time. Do you want to work with me on this? And that's how it happened.
And I obviously felt the same way. I thought it was an incredible memorial to that amazing fireman who passed away on 9/11, and you playing the piano on 9/11 at that specific spot at that subway station, you know, at that mural of that heroic firefighter who died on 9/11. I just thought it was a very powerful piece as well. So
yeah, the way it came together was really beautiful. And those, remember the police who were standing just about a block away were like, hey, you, and they were like, what are you guys doing? Not in any sort of like, not in like, what are you doing? But what are you actually doing? Like, they were just genuinely curious. And,
everyone who walked by too is fascinated by the whole scene of you playing the piano, listening to you play your piano. And what was the song you played?
It was the Nocturne in C sharp minor by Chopin.
Beautiful.
Yeah. And I'm kind of used to the piano is just a crowd magnet. I mean, you can't help. I mean, that part just comes with it. But there was something on that day, because I think we actually filmed it on 9/11 itself. it was on that day that we filmed.
Right. So, it was. Mm-hmm.
So it was in, we were going to film that weekend, the weekend previous, but there were weather conditions or something like that. So we ended up filming it around 9 o'clock in the morning,
right,
on 9/11.
We did. And thank you for that. And thank you. And then, and that's a, that was a beautiful moment, you know, to actually meet in person as well. So
yeah, it was one of those, it's one of those rare instances where the video actually did capture the moment.
It did.
I mean, very often you have a moment and, you know, you can try to take a picture, you can try to video it, you can try to capture it in some way, but really the best thing to do is just put your phone in your pocket and just allow the moment to sweep over.
Right.
Just take it in. But in that case, like, it really actually, what we got really did capture.
Right.
It really did capture that moment. I've gone back and watched it many times myself.
And I think it was important for us to capture it and share it with everyone, you know, in memory of that heroic, the heroic fireman, you know, and fire, you know, firemen in general around, you know, on 9/11 who passed away that day. So it was, I think it was a beautiful memorial. Chris, I have a bunch of questions for you. And one of my first questions for you is, are you a native New Yorker?
Am I a native New Yorker? I mean, I would say at this point, when you pass a certain threshold, I think you can think of yourself as a New Yorker.
And what is that? What is the time frame to become a native New Yorker?
I think it's between 5 minutes and 50 years. It depends on on at what point you cross that in your mind and you think of yourself as a New Yorker. I think it's one of those sort of existential situations where if you cross that line in your own mind and you actually believe in your heart, I'm a New Yorker now.
I agree.
Then you are one.
I have heard also, though, that there is a number of years to become a real New Yorker or a true New Yorker from what I've heard, and which works well with me because I've been here 11 years. But I heard that it's 10 years. If you're here for 10 years, you're a New Yorker. Thank God, I'm a New Yorker now.
I am two New Yorkers.
Yeah.
I am two New Yorkers. I've been here for about 20 years. but I grew up overseas, actually. I'm not from
the right. US. I think it's
all
fascinating.
My parents are American. My father was a photographer. So I actually grew up in Kenya and Greece, and then Indonesia. I'm the eldest of three brothers. My youngest brother was actually born in Africa. I lived there until I was about 7, and then on to Greece, where I lived until I was about 14. And then Indonesia, I came here to the U.S. for the first time. I actually went to boarding school here and then on to college. As soon as I could get out and go back out into the world, though, I did. And so I spent the majority of my adult life back overseas as well. In the interim, right after college, I worked on a huge sailboat. I lucked into a job on a privately owned 127-foot cutter rig catch and sailed across the Atlantic and then all over the Mediterranean. And yeah, my years of wanderlust went on for a lot longer than I think I would have expected, because I was then after that, I moved to Thailand and then Berlin. I had an extended stint in Fiji for no real reason. these were all one way tickets, by the way. As an adult, I would come back to the US and I worked in places like Miami and Boston and just random spots until I could go back overseas again. And I did not plan on returning any of those times.
Mm-hmm.
It was quite literally a one-way ticket. And like when I went to Thailand or Fiji, maybe I had a laptop and a dive mask in a backpack. And that was it. That was all I owned.
The two staples.
because at that point, I wasn't taking my piano with me anywhere.
Right.
I didn't actually own a piano. But everywhere you go, you can find pianos. I mean, I've always been able to practice. You know, if any place in the world that has a church, you can find a piano. I mean, I know where to look because there are certain places where music is inherent in what they do, and you can always find places to practice.
And that leads me to another question. How long have you been playing the piano? And how did you learn?
I have been playing the piano, I would say, most of my life. I never actually took lessons, funny enough.
Wow.
When I was a kid in Greece, my family had a piano in our house, and I would kind of circle around it warily for a couple of years until I finally, I mean, there's like a mystical power to it. I mean, a piano is like, it's like a living, breathing thing almost. It's like,
right.
like really like a living thing. I mean, first off, it's made of wood and felt and things that are of this earth and not, you know, not manufactured plastic. There's something about it that is really just magical, even if you don't play it. So I taught myself to read music almost as like a party trick when I was young. It just came very naturally to me. It was
fascinating.
Really, the music of Scott Joplin was just very mathematically broken down and very rhythmic. It was something that I didn't need to expend a ton of effort on. And so it was never really something that I took enormously seriously because, I mean, Scott Joplin was a genius. Let's just get that straight. Like, it was not because the music of Joplin was not my thing. Like, you know, playing all, you know, his repertoire was amazing, but it was not something that really caught fire in my heart. It was more something that was fun to be able to do. And it was when I was in college, I was actually on a trajectory. I went to architecture school at Rice University down in Houston, but I was on a trajectory at the same time, sort of a parallel trajectory, to go pro as a cyclist. When I was in boarding school in Massachusetts, which is the first time I'd ever been in the States, was when I came here to go to boarding school.
Right.
I found, you know, I was sort of a lonely kid because I'd grown up overseas, but I was a regular looking American kid. And there's, you try explaining to a 13-year-old pack of boys from New England that I'm not from here and they don't even know what you're talking about. Like, I'm not obviously a foreign student. So I fell into cycling that was really my outlet and my solace. And I was riding at the national level when I was very young, like age 14, 15. And I wanted to ride the Tour de France. That was my goal. I wanted to race. I raced nationals when I was in my teens, and I was on a sponsored team. Ended up going to college, to the architecture school down at Rice in Houston. Then I fell sick. I became ill, and they did not know what it was. Rice is right across from the Texas Med Center, and they couldn't find out what it was. And it just got worse and worse and worse. So I was on this like parallel track of going to architecture school, but at the same time, I was thinking of taking a break from college to go ride professionally in Europe, and it all fell apart. It turns out 2 years later, it was Lyme disease. So I had.
Wow. And how did you get it?
It was from a tick.
Yeah.
It was from a tick. And it was from a tick when I was racing in New England after my senior year of high school. Yeah, I was all over the place. I mean, we're at the Olympic Training Center in Lake Placid. And I was racing. I mean, I was all over the place in that senior year. I was really riding at a very elite level. A lot of the cross training was mountain biking. And when you're mountain biking very heavily as a cross training element of your work, you crash all the time because you're not great at it. So I was always covered in scrapes and rashes. And I never noticed the telltale bullseye rash that you get from Lyme disease.
I don't know about it. I don't know.
I never noticed it. It's called a bullseye rash. When you're bit by the tick, and now everybody is aware, I think there's actually a vaccine now. Anyway, I went down to Texas and there was, and it did not exist because this was only a New England disease. And so it got worse and worse and worse over the course of 2 years. And they could not figure out what it was. And so I was unable to do pretty much anything. But there was a piano in the college of my university. Rice has colleges, basically my dorm. And I began to play the piano all the time, and I couldn't be kept off it. And somebody handed me a book of Chopin nocturnes, and I quit going to class. I quit writing, and I really found almost a magnetic form of solace in.
And you said you're self-taught?
And I've remained self-taught at that point still. Yeah, I figured it out. And, you know, music is a very mathematically broken down and systematic language that if you can figure out that X equals X, then you'll know that 2X equals. Music notation is something that you can learn on your own. And then the rest is practice.
I did play the clarinet back in middle school.
Oh,
do have an idea.
So you know what it's all, about. I started to practice absolutely to the detriment of literally everything else.
Right.
And, you know, Rice University does have a conservatory called the Shepherd School of Music. And in my college, there were a couple of students, in particular, one Russian student who was a conservatory concert pianist. And he noticed me always at the piano, and I was getting better at a very suspiciously fast rate. Because it was all I did. I mean, first off, I mean, I didn't go to class. I didn't, you know, I didn't know I had 3 or 4 bikes in my room, but my life of, you know, being a competitive cyclist, you're on the road 6, 7, 8 hours a day training. And it's a lone wolf pursuit. And so the piano just really fell into a very similar type of lane. So I was very good at being alone and being driven and being dedicated to something I loved.
Right.
And when I discovered Chopin, it was like the first great lightning bolt of my life. And this music absolutely overwhelmed me. And I had to make this what I did with my life. And eventually they diagnosed the Lyme disease and I was sent up to Mass General. At that point, it was all over. The piano was what I wanted to do with my life. And it was the first great big pivot. There have been several since that perhaps we'll be able to talk about. But I ended up, I had a full scholarship to a great university, to the architecture school, and I dropped out. I quit. I said, I'm not doing that. I mean, first off, the architecture school was actually taught by, it was very small, and it was taught by full-time architects. And they would come into studio, you know, in their coats and ties, all sweaty and pissed off from client meetings. And I always sort of seen myself 20 years in the future, right. like, is this actually what I want to be doing?
No, I get that too.
it was really quite, it didn't make any practical sense, but it made really a lot of spiritual sense for me to decide to be a concert pianist. And so I left school and I moved to Thailand, like any
back to Thailand
normal person would. Yeah. That was actually my first, and some of Thailand was chosen in part because of the healing properties that it's known for. I mean, the Northern Thailand, you know, the Lyme disease had, there was no real cure for it at that point. It was really battling with this disease that was brand new. The diagnosis was brand new, but at that point I was just out of my mind and I couldn't.
Would you say Thailand is where you perfected your craft?
No, I would say if anything, I have still not perfected my craft. I mean, it's an ongoing journey, right?
Right.
It's like consistently and almost by definition out of reach. You know, it's like a Zeno's paradox where you take a half a step across the room with every step you go halfway and so you can never actually get there. Trying to go for perfection in art is, you just gotta let it go.
Was there ever a point where you knew that you were great at what you do?
Let's take a quick break.
Hey there, I'm Bellamy Young. I'm an actor and a producer. I've been working with the global humanitarian organization, CARE, and I am so excited to invite you along for my new podcast, She Leads with CARE. Each week, you'll meet some incredible women who have changed their lives and their communities.
We raise our voices for people who don't raise their voices to defend themselves.
Listen to She Leads with CARE now on your favorite podcast platform. New episodes every Tuesday.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was in those earliest days. In those earliest days, it was pretty obvious to me because I didn't really feel like there was a barrier between my playing and how I wanted my playing to sound. I did not feel like this was too difficult. I didn't feel like it was too difficult. I didn't feel a lot of the things that I think a lot of people normally get frustrated when it comes to instrumental practice. There's a great concert pianist from early 19th century who it said, do not detest scales, but seek to make them beautiful.
Oh, I love that.
And this is the kind of thing that struck me as a beautiful challenge. I mean, it was, I could do scales all day long. I was perfectly happy doing that kind of work, the kind of technical work that you need to do to be strong on the piano and to become transparent as a pianist. You know, when you're playing music that's been written by other people, the job of the pianist is not to be in the picture at all. And in order to have the technique that allows you to evaporate and let this music be a connection between the composer and the audience, you have to have put in the work.
Well, what is your favorite piece to perform?
You know, it depends on the mood. I think it really depends on where I am and what I'm feeling. Like, for instance, like we were just talking about that C sharp minor nocturne, which, I mean, I played at 9/11, which has this, I think it has this combination of melancholy and hope at the same time, you know, this sort of like double helix paradox that is inherent within that piece makes it perfect for a lot of situations. I chose that piece because I love it. But in the broader sense, I think, you know, back when I was younger, I played everything, you know, I played Beethoven and Rachmaninoff and Bach and Mozart. But I really ended up coalescing my artistic life around the output of Chopin. I found that Chopin, which is kind of a broader answer to your question, is, you know, is there a favorite piece? Well, there are several, but is there a favorite composer? There very much is. And that almost answers a bigger question. Like, what do you play? I actually really only play one guy.
Yeah.
I only play one composer. And I really, because I find that Chopin has really all the colors of the emotional spectrum are in his work.
And the classical pianist. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, I mean, it came down to the fact that if you're playing a lot of different composers, you can be emotionally spread a little too thin. And for some people, it works great. For some people, it's fine.
It works great for you.
to play a smattering of this and a smattering of that. But in the music of Chopin, there's like that nocturne, but there are also like big, dark warhorse virtuoso pieces that are just badass.
Yeah,
I mean, they're just love amazing.
Yep.
And there's, you know, for every human emotion, there's a color to it. And Chopin has all those colors in his palette. And I really just found that after years of playing all sorts of, you know, trying to find my niche, you know, why play so much when there's so much work to be done within the repertoire of Chopin, and just concentrate on Chopin. This is really something that I've never really found that I've ever wanted to turn back on. There's always more. And even narrowed down. I mean, there are particular pieces of Chopin that you can work on for the rest of your life, and you'll never get them truly perfect. You know, it's like Da Vinci said. I mean, a work of art is never completed, merely abandoned.
Right.
And so that holds true for any given set of pieces or any given one piece. You know, if you ask what's my favorite piece to play. It depends on the moment, but there are several that I will be playing for the rest of my life.
Well, have you had a favorite place that you performed?
In New York City, I mean, the canvas of New York City is so broad, and it's so incredible that I can't say that there's any one place. I mean, I've been fortunate enough to, you know, I've gotten tied in with playing with the street art crowd to the benefit of me. More than anything else. I mean, it has been just such a privilege to be able to work with so many different artists and bring in, you know, I push the piano around New York. So this will just sort of answer the question once again, in like a slightly broader way, that what's my favorite place to play? It's where the art is, where the art is at. I found out early on, and it was about a millisecond after I found out that the artists found out as well, that when you play music in front of a work of art, which is, by its own nature, a two-dimensional situation, right? A painting has, you know, a y-axis and a x and y, right? But there's no element of time to it, right? But if you bring a piano up to a big mural that somebody has spent 6 months designing, 2 weeks painting, all sorts of work has gone into the curation of the wall. I mean, in New York City, you can't just find a huge wall. People from Helsinki to Tokyo to Sydney, they all want to paint in New York. Everybody wants to come to New York. And so the big walls are very tightly curated, and they're very, I want to say tightly controlled, because that does not sound like it goes hand in hand with artistic pursuit in general, but it's just the nature of the game that it is hard to find these walls, and only the best artists get the best walls. And the best artists who are painting the greatest murals in the city have spent a very large amount of time designing and painting these murals, right? So what happens is it doesn't take any time to glance at a mural. You can glance at it, you know, okay, got it. Or you can take a picture of it and put it on Instagram, or, you know, put it on social media. But these are the only ways you can really share it. But none of these ways of sharing your art outside of standing in front of it and staring at it, like in Ferris Bueller's Day Off, you know, they're all standing in front of the paintings. Like, I see what he was trying to do here.
Yep.
You don't really get that very often. You know, you almost have to impose discipline upon the eye. And what ended up happening was that the music, in an inadvertent way, would impose discipline on the eye of people who were there listening to what I was playing. And the artists very quickly latched onto this as well. I mean, I don't want to say latched on in any demeaning way. I meant that it was like a discovery. It was like an awakening for, I think, a lot of people who wanted people to spend more time looking at what they had done. I mean, that's what's the point of making art if people aren't going to see it, you know? And so you want people to spend time with it. Yeah. And art is everywhere. So Freeman's Alley,
I love Freeman's Alley.
Is definitely one of my favorites. The artist Viewer invited me into the Park Avenue Tunnel during the pandemic, when the Park Avenue Tunnel was unknown.
Wow.
And it was closed off, and it was absolutely covered in graffiti. And the acoustics were unbelievable. I went down there for the first time. I rolled my piano from the village. I pushed it right up against traffic.
Well, how did you get started just in general performing live around the city?
I mean, that goes back to my handle, Pianist Errant, is right. Based on Don Quixote.
Right. Right.
And not everybody has read Don Quixote, but a lot of people have. But for those who haven't, it's a seminal novel along the lines of Shakespeare. I mean, Cervantes only really wrote, he's a Spanish writer who wrote a book called Don Quixote, which is about a guy who reads so many novels and so many romances about Lancelot and these knight errant types who back 500 years ago who were beholden to no king and just slept under the stars and traveled through forests bringing justice to those in need
mm-hmm.
and slaying dragons and doing right by the world. And this guy, Don Quixote, read so many of these books that he actually went crazy and he thought that he was one. So he put a bucket on his head and he went out to bring justice into the world on his donkey. Like, he actually thought that he was like Lancelot.
Right.
And it was when I read this book, I was actually in Tangier in Morocco when I read this novel. And this was the second great lightning bolt of my life, was realizing that I put two and two together. First off, there needs to be a Don Quixote of the piano. There needs to be somebody bringing a piano around and bringing maybe not justice to those in need, but Chopin to those in need.
Right.
Right. And the reason it really fell into my lap so cleanly and easily was because I had known, as everybody does, maybe not everybody, but most people know that classical music is inaccessible to those who don't have the means to access it. I mean, it's somehow over 200 years, it's become very elite and very expensive and very snobby. And if you don't have $179 for a ticket to Carnegie Hall, you're not going to hear Chopin.
Right.
You know, because there's no place else to hear it. I mean, it's only expensive, black tie. I mean, all the cliches are there for a reason about classical music. And the way I came into it and the way I fell into my solace during these years of illness that I had in my early 20s,
right.
I felt that everybody needed to have access to this. I mean, this was something that really changed the course of my life to the point of defining my life. This beauty and this music. And so it just occurred to me like it did to Don Quixote, to I said, you know what, I'm gonna put a piano on wheels,
right?
Because pianos are very heavy. You can't put it on a sled, you can't put it in a wagon. You know, I mean, I can be crazy, but I'm not an idiot, right? Like, there's a slight difference there,
right?
So I decided that that somebody had to do it, and if nobody's going to do it, then I would. And so that was something.
I'm so glad you do. I was actually Chris and I did a collaboration too down at the new Manhattan Beach.
Oh yes, the Gansevoort Plaza, I think.
Exactly. At the new is it the Gansevoort Beach? Is that
Gansevoort something? Yeah.
Yeah. Down on the Hudson River. And it was beautiful. And I had the pleasure of helping or walking with Chris as he pushed the piano, you know, around the city. And
that was really fun. I usually do this by myself.
Yeah.
Having you along was really quite a, it was great.
For me, it was really fun because I wasn't pushing the piano. But I mean, is it hard to push the piano? It is not.
I mean, it used to be. I'll clarify. So when I first designed this frame, right? So, I mean, how do you put a piano on wheels? I couldn't figure it out. I mean, this was many, many years ago. The first time I did this was in Miami in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a lot of people don't quite realize that I've been doing this for a very long time. That I at first thought I was going to use motorcycle shocks. And it was just idiotic. I couldn't figure out how do you put a piano on wheels that it's going to live on this frame? I designed like a U-frame cradle where the piano is resting in a sort of U cradle frame just by gravity. It's not bolted onto that. And then I found pneumatic casters that were kind of like in a dolly of it at an airport for really heavy bags or like a go-kart, something like that. And they're pneumatic. The pneumatic part of the wheels it was necessary for me to find some way of stabilizing the piano in a way that it wouldn't go out of tune. You can't just put it on hard wheels and push it around because it will get knocked out of tune in 5 minutes.
Ah, oh, that's a good point.
But having tires that are blown up with air,
mm-hmm.
the piano doesn't know where it is. The piano is just wobbling around and you're going over rocks. And I mean, the streets, if you get down on your hands and knees in the streets of New York City, which I don't recommend doing, but if you were to do it, hypothetically, and you rub your hand on the ground, any given 2 feet of this entire city,
right,
you will very quickly see that this is horrible,
right,
surface. Like there's cracks. Even roads that are fine driving a car, when you get down to it.
And plus you're pushing this piano pretty fast.
I'm pushing it pretty fast.
Yeah, because that was kind of running after you.
You've got distance. Yeah, there's distance to cover.
Yeah,
there are places to go. You know, there are things to do. And
you get a big audience, don't you, too, in a sense of people stopping to take photos of you, right, as you're pushing the piano by.
Everywhere. And that's the biggest difference between when I first started doing this and now. That in 2008, there was no social media, nobody had a phone, and nobody had a video camera in their pocket. Now everybody does. And so everywhere you go with the piano, everybody's filming everything all the time.
But you've built an audience, you've grown a fan base. Do people ever recognize you or say anything to you as you're going by?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, yes. All the time and everywhere. Speaking of everywhere, I can just... my favorite places to play, and you know, besides Freeman's Alley, like there is, I think playing in Central Park at night was something that was just absolutely seminal for me.
Yes.
Beautiful. But,
I saw it. It's beautiful.
But as far as going around and answering sort of multiple questions in the same go, when you're that close to the ground, and you'll know, you know this because you do this for a living, walking through the city, there are places between neighborhoods where when you're walking through them, if you look at it on a map, it's a clear delineation between where Tribeca ends and the West Village begins.
Right.
But there's no real delineation there when you're on the actual ground. There are some places like 14th Street is going right between Chelsea and the Village.
Right.
That's a pretty clear line.
Mm-hmm.
But for most places, like going like the East Village and Chinatown and the Lower East Side, and that's it's in those areas that I really feel most at home. And that's one of the things that I really love about what I do, is being able to see so much of this city just from the ground. And everywhere I go, I mean, at first I didn't know what I was going to do. When I first did this in New York, I had no idea what to expect. You know, I'd done this in 2008 in Miami. I very quickly realized that it could not be done in the way that I wanted to, because back then I tried to monetize it. I learned very quickly that there's a very fine line between being a cutting edge avant-garde performance artist and being a busker, right?
Right.
And as soon as that tip jar comes out.
And you don't do tip jars.
I don't do tip jars.
Right.
Because I learned the hard way, way back when, that is the paradox that there's no way around it. You can't monetize it. It simply can't.
Yeah.
If you do it for the money, it's just not going to work.
I thought it was interesting that you don't do, because, you know, when I was with you, you know, I noticed that there was no tip jar ever. You know?
No, and never. I've never actually used
tip jar. I think that's great. I think that's great, actually.
It's the only way that it really is the only way that it can work, is to do it for the art.
Right.
That's why I do it. One thing that's really helped and helped make this possible is social media, and is the ability of people to share it, because then I can actually, you know, charge to perform at given specific locations. Like if a blue chip Chelsea art gallery has an opening.
Right.
You can't hire a band, right? That doesn't make any sense. Like, it doesn't have the right. You know what's exactly right for that kind of thing? Chopin.
Right. And I know somebody who can push a piano there.
And I can put a piano in a parking space on a deserted street in Chelsea,
right,
outside an art gallery. You can't put it in the gallery because it's too loud, but you can put it outside, point the soundboard towards an open door, and it'll fill the gallery with the warm glow of the most beautiful music that's ever been written. And it causes a full scene.
I mean, right.
Everybody at the art gallery opening is out with their glasses of wine and filming and hanging around with the piano.
And how often do you see someone playing the piano out on the streets of New York City? Or in general, anywhere. How often do you see someone playing a piano outside in an open environment?
It is not very common.
Yeah.
It is not very common.
It's amazing.
There are other people who do this kind of thing. There's a guy named Colin Huggins in Washington Square Park.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I know
who's been there for years.
Yeah.
It's just two different kinds of things that we do. And in New York City, I mean, New York City is such a big and wild and artistic and beautiful and crazy place that playing a piano outside is not really that nuts. You know, you get a lot of people who they take a look at you just for like 1 second, like, well, that's why they call it New York.
Right.
Not a big deal. And pushing the piano down the bus lane and the bike lane, like, well, just, you know, better get out of the way for that guy, you know.
Well, I think what you do is amazing with the piano. I absolutely love it. But I want to talk about your book real quick. So Chris wrote a book, and he's going to tell us about it. It's an amazing thriller. And what inspired, tell us about the book, the name of it, what inspired you to write the book.
Sure.
How many have you written, if so?
Sure. Yeah. The book, I have one novel. I have one big novel that took me about 8 years to write this book. It stemmed from the piano. I mean, it stemmed from the fact that I felt a paradox that my favorite music to play was the most melancholy music. I found the most joy in playing the saddest music. And I felt that there was a paradox in there that was very particularly human. Why would you be happiest doing the saddest thing? It's kind of like when you see a Matisse in real life for the first time and you cry tears. Where do those tears come from? How is this joy connected with sadness? And I felt that if you could isolate and extract this paradox, and this was years ago, that perhaps that could be the missing piece of the puzzle to building a strong AI. And back then, this was like crazy sci-fi sort of stuff. I knew that it was the right jumping off point,
right?
Would be to abduct a concert pianist, to kidnap him in the middle of a concert performance at Carnegie Hall by means which you'd have to take a look at the book to find out how they actually do it. But they freeze, they flash freeze his mind, put him on a gigantic sailboat, which I am able to write about because I worked on a big sailboat.
Right.
I mean, everything that's in the book comes from, if you know me really well and you read the novel, like my own parents, for instance, they're like, I see you all through this book, because it's all written from experiences of mine. I mean, it's a purely fictional conceit, but yeah, it's fast paced. And I think that life is so beautiful and huge and so worth living that the years I knew it was going to take to write it were going to be worth it. And, you know, a lot of people think that they have a novel in them, and I think that they do have a novel in them. But I really felt that I had to get this out. I wanted to get it down in writing, and the conflict and the drama and the thrill ride that life is,
right,
I knew could be put into a book. And I've written all my life. It's always been sort of a private thing. But when I came up with this idea for the book, I mean, it's an international thriller that really is, it couldn't have been written without me having led the life of that.
Right.
Life.
All your experiences.
All my experiences are in there.
And have allowed you. Or helped
yeah.
you.
Yeah. I mean, it's very much about that. I mean, the pianist who's my protagonist, I mean, he plays and he thinks like me, and my, you know, and his imagination and his dreams come from my imagination and my
right.
dreams and my hypothetical ideas of what it would have been like to be Liszt, you know, the greatest concert pianist who's ever lived. Like, how would it have been to actually hold on to a borderline supernatural power when it comes to performance and performance art? And it's all in the book. I put it all in there.
And the name, tell us the name of the book again.
The name is The Raindrop Crossing.
Right.
For a while, the name was The Raindrop Prelude, because that's the piece that mm-hmm. the pianist is playing, the Chopin, very famous Chopin yeah. Prelude. When that's the piece that I felt was, that epitomized the moment of paradox, of that melancholy and joy that I was talking about. And so he's abducted during a performance of The Raindrop Prelude. But since he's taken out across the Atlantic Ocean, and everything that happens, crossing was kind of a better way to phrase
it. It sounds
the title.
So fascinating. And, you know, I just bought the book.
I'm genuinely excited.
And I cannot wait to read it.
I think there are plenty of people out there who have written books who, when somebody says, oh, I bought your book and I'm going to read it, then they get nervous.
Yep.
I'm not nervous. I'm excited
yeah.
for you to read it, because I think that.
Well, I know it's amazing because you wrote it. You have such a incredible life. Compared to most people, you have just, you've traveled the world. You've lived in countries all over the world. I mean, I lived in Orlando, Iowa, and New York. That's it. I mean, so your life to me.
It's where you end up that counts. You know, it's like everywhere you go, there
yeah.
you are. And,
yeah.
And that's that's why I'm here, you know, because I think that, you know, when I, having grown up the way I did and then back overseas yeah. for much of my adult life, when I actually came to New York for the first right. time, I came here actually to study with a concert pianist in the Chelsea Hotel. Which is
loved, yeah.
And he actually lived in Sid Vicious's apartment.
Right.
Yes.
That's
the pianist. So my first lesson.
You did that hotel too. It's stunning. Have you seen since they've redone it?
I have been in there. Oh, yeah. I played in there. I played at the old Grand.
Oh, wow.
That's in their lobby. Yeah. I live not too far from there, actually. I live yeah. in Chelsea. So it's,
yeah.
My point was that when I landed in New York, it was almost like out of a cartoon when somebody falls out of the ceiling and they land on their feet, and they're looking around like, where am I? Like, that's what happened. I moved here from Morocco and I sort of crash landed into New York, and I lived in Brooklyn. Like every single artist who's ever moved to New York City starts in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
I think there's, I wasn't trying to follow any track record. That's just what happens.
It is true though. It is.
And it was very early on that, the question of like, what am I running from? Like, where am I going when New York City was where it stopped. And I have felt at home here as a New Yorker. I mean, ever since I got here, really, 20 years ago.
I can completely understand. And so I'm going to ask you one last question. What is your favorite place in the city? I mean, just in general, to play as well, but just in general.
I think that would go back in part to those areas that can't be defined. I mean, I think that, because New York City is about the people.
Exactly.
New York City is not... There's no, I mean, every, you know, anybody, you know, not anybody, but a lot of people would say, oh, the West Village is my favorite, or, the most scenic areas or the areas with the most energy, I couldn't live without like Lincoln Center and the artistic creativity around Carnegie Hall. But that's like, it's almost too concise an answer really for me to be comfortable with. You know, I think that there've been so many beautiful places that I've played and been to, and I mean, to be honest, I've played most places that I've been to because I play everywhere. But
it's a great answer though. I love that answer.
Well, it's true because I think that, there was one time that I was playing down on Bleecker and Bowery. There's a wonderful boxing place, a boxing studio called Overthrow Boxing it's actually built out of an old 1960s counterculture newspaper office. And I was playing down there. The artist Shepard Fairey has a big mural right across the street, which actually is also across the street from the old CBGB. It's just like a very New York centric area. And I was playing and these guys in this boxing gym came out and they decided to spar out in the street while I was playing. It was just really wonderful because, boxing is quite close to dancing and they were out doing their thing. And then because it's New York, they all, they wrapped up, they went out but I was staying out and it was a beautiful spring day and the wind was going through the leaves above me and the sunlight was coming down. And I noticed this guy, once everybody was all done, who'd been sort of standing against a tree. He was an older guy, black dude. He was just watching what was going on. And I didn't have any place else to go once everybody went back into the boxing gym. And I didn't want to acknowledge this guy because it's very easy to scare away the moment.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to say, hey, so what's your name?
Right.
I didn't even really acknowledge that he was there. I was playing for him and I was playing for just the beauty of it. And I kept going and then I just kept going and going and I played for about 45 minutes out there and people were coming and going, but it was like 3 p.m. on a Tuesday or something. Like people have got places to be.
Right.
It wasn't like a big crowd. It wasn't in a park.
Yeah.
And when it was all done and I was wrapped up, this guy came up to me in a sort of cautious way and he sort of conspiratorially leaned down into me and he said, man, you have no idea how much I needed that. And then he was gone.
That's amazing.
And that's my favorite part of the city. I mean, my favorite part of the city is moments like that. My favorite part of the city is New York in general. It's New York. It's the people. And it's moments like that. And being able to be a part of creating moments like that makes me just absolutely the most grateful person I know for what I'm able to do. I love this town, man.
It's interesting because I can relate. You saying that to someone and someone saying that to me living here over the years, just doing what I do with my live videos and stuff. And then saying that to artists too, how they've inspired me and going up and saying, so I know exactly what you mean. That's the beauty of New York City.
Yeah. And that's something I think that for, one New Yorker to another who, and not necessarily, not you and me necessarily, but any New Yorker to any other New Yorker, that's the bond. That's the connection is that people know.
Yeah,
people know that this is it's a New York thing.
It truly is.
And that's why we're here. That's why we're here.
Yeah, so true. Thank you, Christopher, for joining us today for this week's episode of the New Yorkers podcast. I truly, truly, truly mean that. It was an honor to sit here and talk with you.
My pleasure, Kelly.
Why don't you let everyone know where they find you on your social media?
Sure. Yeah, I'm Pianist Errant, like the Knight Errant. Just Pianist Errant on Instagram. I don't do anything else for social media. My novel, The Raindrop Crossing, can be found on Amazon. And that's pretty much it. I like to keep it tight and with a little bow tie around it. I'm not TikToking and YouTubing and all that. It's Instagram for the piano work, Amazon for the novel, and I'll see you there.
Thanks again, everyone, for listening. Please like and subscribe to the New Yorkers podcast.
You can follow the New Yorkers on social media at the New Yorkers podcast.
And please leave a rating or a comment to let us know how you are enjoying the show. We read through all your comments and DMs, so please, we would love, love, love to hear from you, my friends. As always, I am your host, Kelly Kopp, New York City Kopp. Have a lovely day, and we will see you next Sunday.
This is the last stop on this train. Everyone, please leave the train. Thank you for riding with MTA New York City Transit.